The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today I wanted to talk about some basic Buddhist values as opposed to talking about mindfulness practice. And my desire to do so is stimulated by reflections about the second precept. Second precept is the precept not to take what is not given. And in a commercial economy, then buying things that are for sale is considered taking things that are being given, right? So there's taking what is not given. So there are lots of things being given to us. I mean, there's no shortage in the American economy. If you go to stores. So rather than only taking what's given, there's also the value of taking less of what's given. There's a, you know, the idea of taking less and be content with less. And it's quite remarkable that we live in a consumer economy. I remember when, right after 9/11, the President George Bush, one of the ways that he was, you know, encouraging the country right after that big tragedy was to go out and shop. He said, you know, we have to be good consumers, and that's the way to get the economy going and get the country strong again and all that. And consumerism is such an integral part of our society that that's what we're encouraged to participate in by our presidents. Probably many of us don't realize that, maybe you do, that consumerism is an ism in terms of promoting the consumption of goods that had a very clear beginning in the late 1800s when they started to have mass production, industrial production of things, so that things weren't being made by hand anymore, and there started to be a big surplus of goods. So how do you ensure that surplus of goods get bought? Well, you encourage people to buy. And so there became advertisement and a lot of strategy went in, some of them quite clever, to convince people in the United States that it was important to buy more things. And so that's continued. And that continues right up to today, that we're being encouraged and to buy. Shop until you drop. So consumerism is clearly not a Buddhist value. Contentment is a fundamental thing the Buddha emphasized over and over again. And the representative of a life of contentment are the Buddhist monastics. And here's a quote. How is a monastic contented? Here, monastics are content with a robe protecting their bodies, with alms to sustain their stomach. Having accepted enough, they go on their way, going here and there, just as winged birds fly here and there with only the weight of their wings. So the image I have of someone, you know, trying to travel, carrying all their worldly possessions and everything, you know, along, versus someone who's just like a bird, is light and free and can fly. And the metaphor is quite nice, I think, because if there's a freedom in flying through the air that can't be done if the bird is holding onto things, carrying things. And the freedom of the mind through the space of the mind, through this, you know, is enabled by when we're not weighed down by our attachment and concern with things and getting more and more. So this idea of being content with the robes and the food that one has, it goes a little bit further, this idea of contentment. Here, monastics are content with any kinds of robes. Alms food, lodgings, and medicine and provisions for the sick. So there's four requisites that monastics are allowed to own. They're allowed to own their robes. They're allowed to own the food that they were given that day up until noon. But they can't store it. They have to give it away. And then their own lodging and their own, and they're allowed to have medicine, called the four requisites. And for, you know, I think for kind of an affluent society like relatively we are, in this, compared to much of history and much of the world, it can seem like the ascetic lifestyle is an ascetic one, one of denial, one of deprivation, one of, you know, doing without. The Buddha specifically designed the monastic life to not be that. There were lots of examples in ancient India of people being ascetics, and the Buddha tried to be an ascetic and found that it didn't work. But he also didn't want people to be too busy and preoccupied with their material goods and their protection of it and all these things. And so he tried to design a monastic life, a life where people had just enough to be comfortable, but not too much. And so because it's so, it doesn't take actually that much for a human being to be comfortable, these monastics end up with very little. Just a sheet that they wrap around them, a bowl, and lodging, and then their medicine that they're allowed to have. And then it gives them lots of time for other things. And the ideal, it gives them lots of time to practice. So the Buddha also said, the Dharma is for one who is content, not for one who is discontented. Benjamin Franklin, I think, who said, "People who are content are wealthy." Even if you're poor, if you're content, you can be wealthy. There are wealthy people who are discontented who are poor. And many years ago, I met a man who was specialized as a therapist to work with people who are very wealthy. That was his specialty. And his specialty was working with people who were very wealthy who felt that they were poor. You know, that millions and millions of dollars, and they felt like, I don't have enough. And they had enough sense to know that that was a bit of a problem. So they came to their therapy, and that was his thing, to help them with that. If you'd come to the Buddha, probably to ask for therapeutic help, you probably would have told them, just give it all away. Start over again. So the idea of contentment, to be content with what one has, when one has enough, is a very, very important Buddhist value, partly because it keeps the mind from being agitated. And I think many of us can recognize the agitation that comes from wanting and shopping and acquiring and keeping and protecting and so forth. There's a wonderful little story from the suttas of a very wealthy man who became a monastic. So he had lived a life of luxury, and it was a big transition to go become a monastic. And so he was living in that kind of, back then they often lived in the woods, and so he was living in the woods with other monastics. And the other monks were talking to each other and say, well, you know, so-and-so, he's not going to last here. You know, this is too difficult for him, having lived a life of luxury. So then one day they overheard him. He was, in the distance, he was meditating. And they heard him exclaim, happy, 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 I'm so happy. And the other monks looked at each other and said, you see, he's giving up the monastic life and going back. You see? And so they went and asked him, and he said, no, I'm not giving up this. I'm just so happy. I don't have to have guards at my door and lock things and worry about everybody stealing my stuff. I can just sit here in the open and meditate and not worry about anything. And I'm so happy about this. So the simplicity that contentment can allow is a big boon for people who want to do something different in their life, want to And that comes to the second principle or value that I wanted to convey here today. So the first value is that of contentment. Second one is worded this way. Acquiring material goods is not a Buddhist value. Acquiring wholesome, inspiring states of mind is. So the switch is from focusing on possessions to focusing on the quality of our mind. And the only person who could be the caretaker, safeguarder of the quality of our own mind is ourselves. It's one of the most intimate and personal aspects of anybody's life. The state of one's mind, one's own inner happiness, well-being, inner purity, inner sense of freedom, the mind states that a person cultivates and develops, sustains, protects. That's really up to us as individuals to do that. And in Buddhism, that is considered to be the true wealth. The Buddha was quite explicit that if you really want to be wealthy, you want to have these beautiful inner qualities of mind that are cultivated and developed. And you don't want to just leave it to chance that you might someday just wake up and there's a nice state of mind, maybe you're lucky, you go for a walk on a sunny day and, you know, maybe it'll put you in a good mood. That's kind of, doing it by chance. But what can we do to cultivate and develop, to acquire these positive states of mind? One of them that the Buddha emphasized was contentment. So cultivating contentment, being content with having the requisites and the basic needs. It's not quite maybe a little bit of a non sequitur, but I'm so delighted in this ancient story. So Ananda is was one of the close disciples of the Buddha. And the women from the king's harem came to see him, and he taught them. And they were so delighted at the receiving teachings from him that they gave him a gift of 500 robes. Monastics are allowed to accept things that are given, but 500 robes, poor little Ananda. So it was a lot. So he accepted them, and the women then left. Then they ran into the king. And the king said, "Where have you been?" "Oh, we've been listening to Ananda. It was so great." "And how'd that go?" "It was so great. We gave him 500 robes." And the king said, "What? That's a lot of robes." And he said, "How can this recluse, Ananda, accept so many robes? Will he set up trade in woven cloth, or will he offer them for sale in a shop?" You know, he's certainly, he's there for his own benefit, and he's going to sell it and become wealthy. So then the king went to find Ananda. And he said to Ananda, "Did the women from the harem come to see you?" "Oh, yes, they did," Ananda said. "Did they give you 500 inner robes, 500 robes?" And Ananda said, "Yes." "But," the king said, "what can you, Honorable Ananda, do with so many robes?" "I will share them, Your Majesty, with those monks whose robes are worn thin." "But what will you do, good Ananda, with those old robes that are worn thin?" "We will make them into bed coverings, Your Majesty, bed sheets." "But what will you do, good Ananda, when those sheets are old?" "We will make them into mattress coverings, Your Majesty." "But what will you do with those mattress coverings that are old?" "We will make them into ground coverings." "But what will you do, good Ananda, when those ground coverings are old?" "We will make them into foot wipers." "But what will you do, Ananda, when those foot wipers are old?" "We will make them into dusters." "But what will you do, Ananda, when those dusters are old?" "Having worn them into shreds, Your Majesty, having kneaded them into mud, we will smear a plaster flooring." And then the king says, these monks of the Buddha use everything in an orderly way and do not let things go to waste. And he therefore bestowed on Ananda an other set of 500 So be careful if you're too frugal, the people just don't give you more. But this idea of, you know, not throwing things away casually, discarding things, but to really use things well, it also goes against, you know, the principle of consumerism. It's better to have things, you know, be obsolete quickly, so they, because then you can throw them away and then you can buy more. The more you can buy, the more someone will be happy. And it might not be you, but... So this idea of acquiring wholesome, inspiring states of mind. And some of those will come in the wake of practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness has a remarkable ability to reveal ways in which we're caught, attached, constricted around certain mind states, and then to release that constriction. And when the mind gets less and less constricted, the constricted mind states, greed, hatred, delusion, can't sustain themselves. So there's quite something to do mindfulness and discover these beautiful states of mind that can arise. There's joy. There's mindfulness itself is a beautiful state of mind. There's equanimity. There's a concentrated mind. There's happiness. There's equanimity. There's all kinds of things that can arise. But these things can also be cultivated directly. And one of the ways to cultivate them is to the degree to which they start showing themselves in our lives, they're there, is to recognize them quickly. If you start feeling a little bit of joy as you practice, as you get kind of healthy joy as you go through life, the clear acknowledgement of that and recognition is a way in which makes space almost for them to grow and develop. It kind of recognition of these positive states is food for them to grow. To the degree to which you have generosity, a state of generosity, that even if you have an inkling, just like a little hint, like maybe I should be generous, just that enough movement and really recognize that and don't overlook it. Don't rush off to the next thing, but spend time really acknowledging and noticing the qualities of mind that come through, that pass through your mind, that are really healthy and wholesome and good and inspiring even for you, even if it's, you know, just hints at first. Then they can grow and develop. One can take a particular quality of mind that one is inspired by and or wants to have it be part of your life and focus on it as a specialty for some time. Study it in other people. If you like the idea of joy, go look at people who are, have joy and see what, you know, just kind of be around them and maybe something will rub off. And then maybe it's a little bit of a non sequitur, but yeah, 'cause it has to do with this consumerism thing. Possessions. There's this wonderful, I guess, folk tale of a man who, a wealthy man, I guess, who is really unhappy and goes to a wise person and says, you know, how can I be happy? And so the wise person says, go find a person. Find a person who is truly, truly happy. And bring me his shirt or her shirt. Well, that's a good task. So the person goes across the land and asks for, are you happy? And people said, well, you know, sometimes. And some people say, oh, you should ask that person over there. That person's happy. And they find out, are you truly, truly happy? And they say, well, I'm happy a good percentage of the time, but not all the time, not truly, truly. The person spends years looking for the person who's truly, truly, you know, happy. And then he, at some point he got hearing from people, there is a person like that. Just over the next mountain, there is a person who's truly, truly, truly happy. And so he's so excited, and he gets closer, and gets closer, the people there, they're kind of a little bit shiny and smiling when they think about him and talk about him. Feels there's so much confidence in people's eyes when they talk about this man. Certainly, this who he's coming to must be a happy man. If everyone, he has this effect on people. And so he gets closer and closer, and he's so excited. He's going to find the truly, truly, truly happy person. And he finds him. And he just looks so happy. He looks like delighted. But he doesn't have a shirt. And I don't know what the moral of the story is, but I take it to be that I take the moral to be that you know, as long as you're concerned with possessions, you're not going to really be happy. If your happiness is through possessions, not it. It's some kind of relinquishment, at least of attachments to possessions, that is important. So then we come to the last of the three Buddhist values that I wanted to convey today. And that is, to fulfill all desires is impossible. To be free of all desires is possible. To fulfill all your desires is not possible. To discover how to be free of your desires is possible. It's quite a difference between that. And so here's another quote from the Buddha. Again, explaining some of the ideal ways of being in the world. So it's always in reference to monastic, these ideas. So, and ideally, a monastic has few wishes, contentment, simplicity, is easy to support, and energetic. So these are some of the values that are championed in this ancient tradition. But fewness of wishes. And I remember when I was, in my about 20 or so, that I used to get exhausted sometimes by my desires. Literally, when I go into bookstores. They used to have bookstores then. And I would go in. And I was always surprised. I would leave bookstores. I was always happy to go in, kind of happy to be there. And I would always leave tired, exhausted. And it took me a while to understand why. It was because I didn't have any money, but I basically wanted all the titles that I saw. Like that, I want that. And that kind of nonstop wanting, the wanting machine inside of me, was exhausting to do. I'd been an hour in the bookstore, and by the time I left, it was the movement of wanting that was exhausting. And I don't know if any of you have ever had so much ongoing wanting and wanting, wanting, that it's tiring. It can certainly be quite limiting for our minds, for our hearts, to be caught up in desires, and desires for all kinds of things. Because the desire to have a desire for something is to not be present for what is. To have a desire for something is to be future thinking, out there thinking, over there thinking. The desire, the object of desire is there, maybe in the future, maybe in the present. And there's a kind of too easy to kind of lose contact with oneself in that process. In the extreme form, we talked about objectification of people. You know, we desire people in a certain way, and there's objectifying the people. But there's also doing that for all kinds of objects that we want as well. We objectify them because they can fulfill all kinds of needs we think we have, all kinds of desires we have, all kinds of projections, all kinds of, kind of crazy ideas we have about what it's going to do for us. And so we're not really in touch with ourselves if we're living in the world of desire. And so to be able to have fewness of wishes does a number of things. It allows us to reconnect with ourselves in a deeper way, be here for ourselves. It allows us to kind of turn the attention around so we become the caretakers of our inner life in a useful, productive way. It also is frees up a lot of energy. To spend a lot of time concerned with wanting, wanting, wanting is tiring. Then there's also having few desires does something very, very important, and especially in meditation. If you can manage in meditation to really put down your desires really thoroughly, maybe completely, and experience the quality of the heart, quality of your inner life that is desire-free, you've experienced a diamond. You experienced a treasure. You experienced something pristinely beautiful. Some people would say, some of the most beautiful things you can possibly experience in this universe. And there are beautiful things to see, you know, out there, the night sky or all kinds of things. But one of the most beautiful things you'll ever encounter is a mind or heart that has no desire. It has no agitation. It's like looking into clear water where it's unruffled surface and completely clear. It's a beautiful thing to have that unagitated mind, settled mind. So to move towards, at least in meditation, to be mindful of our desires and all the wantings we have, to understand that maybe it's not in our best interest to pursue them, to step back from them, to see the contraction around them, to allow the contraction to relax and settle, and to be able to discover how to breathe easily and be at ease in some deep way without the grip of desires, without wanting, is one of the great things to do. So to tie this together with the beginning about contentment, if contentment is an important Buddhist value, you can desire contentment, or you can find contentment in a different way than desiring it. And in fact, it might be that it's the absence of desire that leads to contentment, rather than desiring contentment. Because if we desire contentment, and we work towards contentment, and we set our will towards contentment, I'm going to be content. And I'm the agent who's going to make myself content. It's actually not a lot of freedom in that. It's actually can very often reinforce the conceit of me, myself, and mine. It could actually be reinforcing the movement of desire. Not a few meditators have let go of worldly desires and substituted spiritual desires in its place and tied themselves in knots sometimes, or spent years busily pursuing this desire for spiritual states and wonderful things. It's a kind of a radical thing to do, but to begin appreciating in some the absence of desire, to settle back and begin getting a feel or a taste, to savor what it's like just to be present in a very simple, ordinary way, to be aware, to breathe, and to be here without having a desire. Can we do it looking out the window, sipping a cup of tea? Can we do it for a simple walk around the block? Where in our life can we allow ourselves the gift of that simplicity, just being aware and not needing anything to happen, not have anything at stake, not pursue anything, just be? And that's where real contentment is found. That's where the kind of mindfulness that we're ultimately trying to develop in this practice arises out of. It isn't that that mindfulness also, if there's a lot of desire behind your mindfulness, like I'm going to do this so I can get something, and you know, I need to get these special spiritual states, or I need to be, you know, develop, I want really good mindfulness. You can have some success with that. I mean, desires, you know, it can work to some degree. There's a place for a wise desire, for sure. But there's a different kind of mindfulness that can bubble up or surface or blossom when blossoms in the space of having no desires, the contentment of few or no desires. The natural awareness that comes when we settle back, we're relaxed, we're here. And in that open awareness, relaxed awareness, awareness that's not being pushed around by desires, it's almost like it's makes space for mindfulness to bubble up and become strong. And it's not so much something we do, but something that we enable. It's not something that we make happen, but rather it's something that we support to happen. And that's a very different feeling to do it that way. And one of the reasons why it's useful is that that's pointing towards a real freedom, which is the direction of this path that's taking us to freedom, deep inner freedom. It doesn't leave us with nothing. And having no desires doesn't leave us with nothing, but it does make us content to have nothing. What do you think of that? It doesn't leave us with nothing, but it does leave us content to have nothing. And but then what comes out of that? If mindfulness can come out of that, if these beautiful qualities can come out of that, maybe everything we do need will blossom out of us, rather than us being anxious that if I don't do something, I won't take care of the world, I won't take care of myself, I won't be a responsible person, or this and that. What if being a responsible person in this world, responsible for ourselves, responsible for our society around us, what if that also is something that can bubble up in this place where there's no desires? And maybe motivation then is not desire-based. What do you think of that? Motivation that's not desire-based. So what is, you know, that's a strange thing for Gil to say. What could he mean that? What's the alternative to desire? And what is desire that we want to put to rest? And what motivation is left and that it will keep me from just being a couch potato? So consumerism is not a Buddhist value. Contentment is. Acquiring material possessions is not a Buddhist goal. Acquiring wholesome, inspiring states is. Fulfilling all our desires is not possible. To be free from all desires is possible. Three Buddhist values. May you reflect on these and think about them, and may it somehow allow something to blossom from the inside out. May you be the caretaker of your own inner life. Thank you. And we have a couple of minutes. If you want to ask one or two questions, or if you want to protest, you're welcome to.
So would that motivation be replaced with what? Inspiration?
That's a great idea. You come back and tell us what you discover.
This is an impertinent question, but where are you at?
108 Birch Street. look satisfied. Apparently you want something.
As you were talking, yeah. I was wondering, obviously I'm putting you on the spot, but where you're at in terms of dealing with wants.
Wants? It's a fair question. So I have a reference point for the mind that has desires. That a reference point of having really experienced a complete freedom from desires. It's kind of it was very powerful and very important for me. So it's made me very sensitive to the movements of desires and the contraction and all that. And there's certain kind of desires that I simply don't follow, not interested in doing anymore, because it just doesn't just not interesting anymore. I have other desires that maybe I shouldn't be interested in, that maybe I still kind of pursue, and so I practice with those and look at them and work with them. I also have discovered that there's other sources of motivation that exists inside of me that I don't associate with attached desire or craving or compulsive desire. and it comes from something deeper. And what that's deeper motivation that arises up, that puts me in the world and motivates me to do things, and you know, I do a lot of things, is something that I trust, but it's still something that's being refined and purified and understood. And so, so where I'm at with this is I'm still, it's a still very personal study of all this, exploring this, understanding this, and trying to be very respectful of this inner life that I have. So the problem with the kind of talk I gave today about having few wishes or being free of all desires, it's too easy then to kind of think that all desires are bad and to push them aside and not really listen. There's a wide range of different kinds of desires, and some of them are neurotic. Some of them are clearly, you know, filled with attachments. And some of them arise out of deeper places. And but when they arise out of a place that seems to have very little self or no self, for example, compassionate desires can arise. We do ourselves a disservice, we do the world a disservice if we squash it. So maybe we don't call that a desire in the Buddhist sense of it. And so I sometimes like the word aspiration as an alternative. And I like the word aspiration because it's connected to the word breath in Latin. So that when our breath is easy, at ease, then what comes out of us when we have an easy breath? So, thank you all. And may you discover the great joy and delight and peace of contentment. Thank you.